This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Jeremiah Jacques, contributing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. I'm substituting for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker, and we really appreciate you tuning into the Trumpet Hour to learn about the big news stories of the week. For our panel today, here in the studio in Edmond, Oklahoma, we have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And Anthony Chibadiwe.
Greetings.
Joining us from our UK office is Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And joining us from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Hi.
Well, the big news this week is that after 20 years of negotiations, the European Union and Latin America have clinched a massive, history-altering trade deal with implications for each one of us. To bring us up to speed on this, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, I'll start this with just a remarkable quote from the Plain Truth magazine, Herbert W. Armstrong's publication, all the way back in 1962. He wrote, this magazine wrote, "The United States is going to be left out in the cold as two gigantic trade blocs, Europe and Latin America, mesh together and begin calling the shots in world commerce." And that quote might sound familiar. We quote it relatively frequently on this show. It's an important forecast from Mr. Armstrong. And last Friday, we saw that pretty much happen. We saw two trade blocks mesh together. Now, this deal still has some hoops to get through, and I think that's important, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. But they've done. They have agreed on a draft deal. They're going to get together. So Mercosur is one of the most important Latin American trade blocks. This deal includes its four core members of Brazil, Argentina, Paraguay and Uruguay, and this is a trade bloc that puts very high tariffs on goods coming from everywhere else in the world. Now, European goods will be let in without those tariffs in general, while those high tariff walls will remain in place, keeping out goods coming from Europe's competitors. So it really does lay the foundation for a very close economic relationship between these two. But then if you look at all of the rhetoric from all of the leaders talking about this, it's about more than economics. They're talking about forging an alliance. They're talking about bringing the two together. That's why all of these leaders made statements like it's a truly historic moment, the most important trade deal we've signed in our history. We're seeing these two trade blocks mesh together exactly the way Mr. Armstrong and the Plain Truth said that they would.
So you mentioned that the deal is rapidly moving forward now. It's almost finalized, but that there are still some hurdles to be crossed for it to be 100% official. What are those remaining hurdles?
All right. So Mr. Flurry spoke on this subject. He had a Key of David in January on this deal. Again, that's another indication of how important this is. It was on the cover of our March Trumpet print magazine as well, where he had an article pointing to this deal, saying how historic it would be if they got this together this year. They've now got it together this year. But in that article, he had one one that I'll mention right now, particularly interesting piece of analysis, where he basically said that, well, we know that the European Union is going to pare down to 10 nations. The Bible talks about a 10-nation superpower in Europe. And he said, well, if this deal goes ahead, and if it happens in 2019, I think we're going to see Europe pare down to this 10 nations in 2019 as well. That if Europe's going to have this strong relationship to Catholic Latin America, well, they will need to become less, move away from being this big unwieldy bureaucratic monstrosity and become something that's much more streamlined, something that's able to make decisions much more quickly, something that's able to work effectively with these Latin American countries. And so he made that forecast, and now the deal is agreed, but every single one of these 27 EU nations has to sign off on it before it becomes official. And that is not going to be an easy process. You've got a lot of opposition, especially in the agricultural industry, to this deal. I mean, as far as the French farmer is concerned, the only reason the EU exists is to protect him from competition from cheap food grown abroad. And now they're coming along and cheap food is going to be allowed in from Argentina, cheap Argentinian beef and Brazilian beef coming into Europe. There's a lot of people very angry at that. And so it's not going to be easy to get 27 different parliaments to sign off on this. At the same time, like we said, there's a whole lot of people in the European Union very excited about this deal, very committed to this deal. So given what Mr. Fleury said, I do wonder, as we see that go through that process, whether that will play a role in paring the European Union down from the 27 nations to 10 nations that are actually able to move forwards and make these kind of deals and get them signed off and put into practice quickly, rather than just a long, protracted set of negotiations.
A lot to keep our eye on there. So for two decades, this deal was something that strong elements on both sides wanted, but they were never able to get it past the negotiation phases. The talks for many years would stall and restart. Why is it suddenly coming to life now?
President Trump. Mm. That's kind of the simplistic answer. But you've got a president in the White House who's standing up for America now. And I think that's exposing a lot of anti-Americanism in a lot of countries around the world. And you see this especially in Europe. You see it in Germany, where one study, I can't remember the exact figure, but it said, I think, that the news coverage was about 96% anti-Trump coming from the public one of the public broadcasters over there.
Wow.
So a huge amount of negativity directed at the United States. It wasn't such a big deal under Mr. Obama because he didn't really stand up for America. So I think, Europe didn't like America. He didn't like America either. So they kind of got on fine. Now you've got someone standing up, though. It really has brought a lot of that anti-Americanism to the fore. And so all of these different nations are trying to work together, get together, even in opposition to America. The other factor for that, of course, is that Donald Trump is threatening trade war with Europe and even Latin America, with Mexico. They've been caught up in some of this. So there's this strong interest from everyone to make themselves less dependent on the United States. And that's kicked everyone into overdrive in terms of making these deals. So Europe did a deal with Mexico last year. They created the world's biggest trade area with Japan earlier in the year, only to top it with the new world's biggest trade deal with this deal with Mercosur. So President Trump's a big factor behind the timing of this.
So you mentioned that the Plain Truth magazine was writing about this very development that we've just seen this week taking place all the way back in the early 1960s. They were specifically forecasting this very thing under Mr. Armstrong. Could you talk a little bit more about that and just why the Bible's prophecies had the Plain Truth magazine looking for this sort of thing, and why the trumpet is now has also been sort of forecasting the same?
So one of the keynote warnings from Mr. Armstrong was about the rise of this Holy Roman Empire in Europe. Revelation chapter 17, for example, talks about this beast power, a political power in Europe that has an alliance with the church that rises and falls. It's on the scene sometimes. It goes underground. It disappears from the world scene. It comes back again. And if you look at history, well, where do you see that pattern? And you see it with the Holy Roman Empire in Europe. You see that this power, that it has a close relationship with the Catholic Church. It's there. It's really powerful. It disappears. It comes back again later. And you look at history, and that power, since pretty much the time of Columbus, has had a very strong link with Latin America. There's the very clear religious link, but then a whole load of the different resurrections of this power have had a close relationship there. So that's an important part of this prophecy. And if this power is going to come on the scene one more time, well, then you would expect those links, those Catholic links with Latin America, to be revived one more time. And then we can get, I think, a bit more information about this prophecy by looking at other forecasts that talk about the United States being besieged economically. You have Deuteronomy 28 that talks about the curses that will come on America if the nation doesn't submit to God. And one of those is talking about the nation being besieged in all its gates, being cut off from world trade. And you can put that side by side with other scriptures and see that this Holy Roman Empire, this European power, plays a major role in that siege. So, okay, if somebody's going to cut the United States off from world trade, how do you do that? Well, you need a presence in Latin America. Most of America's overseas trade into or international trade travels through the ports around the Gulf of Mexico there. So you need to have a presence there if you're going to be able to restrict that maritime traffic. So you put that side by side and you see that this rising European power is going to have a strong link to Latin America and has a very with that religion has a very easy basis for a strong link with Latin America. That's what led the Plain Truth to make those forecasts. That's why Mr. Flurry put such an emphasis on that on the cover issue of our March Trumpet print edition as well.
Richard also covered this in even more depth on the Tuesday episode of the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, so we'll be sure to include a link to that in our show notes for today. What other literature would you point people to there, Richard?
Yeah, mostly that cover article from Mr. Flurry, America is being besieged economically. That puts it in its full biblical and historical context.
Okay, we'll be sure to include a link to that there as well. Thanks very much for that, Richard. Well, we've been hearing for many years now how close Iran may be to developing nuclear weapons. And this week, there were some very concerning developments toward that end. For this, we'll go to our man in the Middle East, Brent.
Yeah, Iran announced that it had formally breached the 3.67% enrichment that it's allowed to under the Iran nuclear deal. So now they are producing more than 300 kilograms of that, and they said that if they don't get their way, they're going to increase that to 20% soon as well. So there was that news. There was also a really important article that came out in the Wall Street Journal entitled Behind Iran's New Aggressiveness. And it was a really incisive analysis by Michael Doron. He used to work for the State Department and then the NSA as well. And so he understands what's going on here. And Mr. Bolton, the Secretary of State, basically backed up his analysis. And it really exposed what Iran is very concerned about right now. We tend to focus on Iran's actions that have picked up since early May, hitting the tankers in the Persian Gulf, striking the Saudi pipeline as well, in terms of Iran isn't getting money. They've got the strict financial sanctions on Iran right now. Their oil revenues have plummeted. Its economy is in free fall, and they're not getting the money that they need to survive. And so they're going to hit back in ways to try and get some type of better negotiating position, I guess, with the Trump administration, what have you. Mr. Doron came along and said it's not their actions right now are not about the financial sanctions. They're about the other part of the nuclear deal that was enshrined by the nuclear deal, and that was their access to a peaceful nuclear program. That is now coming under attack by Mr. Trump. I'd just like to quote from this article right now because it gives it, you'll understand what I mean. He says here, the JCPOA, which is the nuke deal, gave Iran two big concessions, economic sanctions relief and an international blessing for its peaceful nuclear program. Last November, the U.S. Treasury fulfilled President Trump's order to end the nuclear deal by taking away Iran's economic sanctions relief. But the State Department, in response to European lobbying, issued seven waivers whose purpose was to support international partnerships on the nuclear projects generated by the nuke deal. So if I could just break this down for everybody, they get lots of money for the nuclear deal, and they also get this peaceful program preserved that they can produce nuclear fuel for a peaceful program. And to enshrine that, you had other nations that help Iran in this process. For example, at one of their nuclear facilities, the Fordow nuclear facility that we know was used for the illicit construction or the move towards producing a nuclear weapon, right now it is being used to develop medical equipment, and Russia is helping them do that. So this is one of those seven waivers that they received. Mm-hmm. You can go along and continue to use the Fordow nuclear plant to produce this medical equipment with the Russians. And so by allowing that to happen, even currently, it has protected the Fordow facility from destruction, from being broken down, from being poured in with cement, so that at some point Iran can push forward towards a nuclear agreement. Well, the United States back in May said, we're going to start working on those sanctions, on those waivers, and they've already struck two of the seven. And so the Ayatollah is very scared that he is no longer going to have access to a peaceful, as he would say, nuclear program.
So is the concern from the United States just that if you allow Iran to enrich uranium, you know, to just a couple of percentage points for nuclear power plants, that they could quickly take that same fuel, further enrich it, and sort of go toward weaponry?
Right. So all of these things that were negotiated under the JCPOA, Iran was very smart. They basically protected their infrastructure so that they can produce a bomb when they want to. They put a temporary hold on that. They don't destroy any of their facilities. They don't say we're walking away from a nuclear program. They say they have civilian purposes, but we know, and this is evidenced by the Israeli, you know, that huge Israeli raid into Tehran last year, where they brought out tons of documents that shows that Iran had a clandestine nuclear program to produce a weapon. They were using the same facilities that they want for a civilian purpose for an illicit weapons program as well.
So it looks like Ayatollah Khomeini and the others in the Iranian leadership there are basically kind of provoking a crisis to frighten the European leaders into, you know, just being afraid of the possibility of war at worst and economic disruption at best, probably, in order to make the European leaders put pressure on the United States leadership to maybe give Iran some concessions here. Do you think that could be an effective strategy?
Well, it worked last time. I mean, it has worked before. I mean, the other big story in this as well, going along with that, that if they increase tensions with the United States, the Europeans come along and say, hey, Mr. Trump, you don't want a war right now. That's what the Ayatollah is basically betting on, that President Trump does not want a war with Iran before the 2020 election because it might lose him his presidency. They've even said that as much. One of his advisors this week came out and said, hey, we've removed a United States president before. That's what one of the Iranians said. And they did back when they had the Iranian hostage crisis, which removed Carter from office. So there is ways of really, like, either, you know, making it so dangerous in the Middle East that Trump has to go to war, which would be bad for him politically because Americans won't like that since he, you know, was elected on not going to war in the Middle East. That could be an option for them, nuclear blackmail, basically, or at least blackmail in the sense of by the Iranians of upping the stakes before the election. This is what he writes at the end of his piece here, Michael Duran. He says, Iran's greatest achievement in the JCPOA, or the nuclear deal, was not relief from economic sanctions, but winning international legitimacy for its nuclear weapons program and seeking to restore these lost waivers and safeguard the other five. The Ayatollah believes he has an ace up his sleeve, Trump's desire for re-election. Then it says at the end, the nuclear deal established a legal pathway for Iran to pursue a nuclear bomb and a set of international partners, whether they realize it or not. That is the Russians, the Chinese, the Europeans that are all in deals with the Iranian nuclear peaceful program right now. They are protecting Iran's nuclear, clandestine nuclear program. And so this piece is saying that Mr. Trump increased the financial sanctions and it hurt Iran. But then he touched the precious nuclear program of Iran starting in May 2nd. And since May 2nd is when we've seen all these actions by Iran against the United States. And it's because the United States is taking aim at the civilian, as they would say, nuclear program. And according to the Ayatollah, don't touch our nuclear program. It's very important for Iran to keep that infrastructure in place for the future.
Kind of a red line for the Iranians there. Could you place this in the context of Bible prophecy and just let the listeners know where they could go to read more about it?
For sure. With Mr. Gerald Flurry has talked about this even recently, how he believes that Iran is going to get a nuclear weapon. Again, the nuclear deal did not stop Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. It basically pressed pause. And right now this week, they said that they are moving past the threshold that takes down that nuclear window from about a year to produce a nuclear bomb from right now. That window is shrinking in time to less than a year. And so we expect them to charge forward towards that and do anything that they need to ensure that they have a nuclear program. And people can read about that and how Iran is pushing towards this in fulfillment of Bible prophecy. In Mr. Flurry's book, The King of the South, it talks about how Iran is the power that's going to lead the world towards war, and it's probably not going to do it just with a few drones and a few use of its fast boats in the Persian Gulf. There might be more to it, and its nuclear weapon program could be a big part of that.
We'll be sure to include a link to that in the show notes. Thanks very much for that, Brent. Well, it was back in September of 2015 when Chinese President Xi Jinping stood in the Rose Garden with U.S. President Barack Obama, and he promised him that China would not militarize the South China Sea. In the years since then, we've seen lots of evidence showing that that promise was broken. And this week, another glaring bit of evidence showing just how empty it was came out. To tell us about this, we'll go to Anthony.
Last Saturday, China closed off a section of the disputed South China Sea and warned other ships against sailing near the area for 5 days. And that's because China over the weekend, for 5 days since over the weekend, was conducting military drills in these extremely volatile waters. NBC News reported on Tuesday that during the drills, China conducted a series of anti-ship ballistic missile tests, and this could be the first time that China actually fired missiles during tests in the South China Sea. One of them landed in the sea there. And it's a disturbing development, and Pentagon officials were very quick to point that out. And one of the Defense Department spokespeople, they actually brought back the history that you brought up in the introduction, just that promise. In fact, he even talked about the specific statement that Xi Jinping made in the Rose Garden in 2015, and just saying that it just shows that China was lying. That was obvious that China was lying back then. It was a blatant lie back then, but probably few people really realized that, or at least cared enough about it. But now it's just becoming a lot more clear that it was a blatant lie, and lies of serious consequences.
Yeah, it's remarkable that, if we go back 5 or 6 years, these militarized outposts and islands that China now has there in the South China Sea, they didn't even exist. These were partially submerged or fully submerged little atolls and reefs. And it's just been such a dramatic transformation and just such a rapid militarization of that area. But it does just show how naive many in the West were to believe China when the president looked the U.S. president in the eye and said, not to worry, these are just for civilian purposes. Could you place this in the context of Bible prophecy for us?
Yeah, China. One thing just to note before I proceed is that China has really been nonstop in this pursuit. It has just continued pursuing it because there is such tremendous economic and political and military benefits for China of just continuing on with this strategy. About $5 trillion worth of trade passes through the South China Sea. Many other nations like the United States, the Philippines, Taiwan, Japan, Australia, France have been disturbed by Chinese belligerents in this area and have conducted military exercises of their own. But China has remained undeterred all the way. And unfortunately, this situation will continue to deteriorate until full-scale war breaks out. That's what Bible prophecy indicates. Bible prophecy identifies China as a rising superpower that will actually unite with some Asian nations and becoming this strong economic powerhouse that will wage trade wars, form these trade alliances that will be to the detriment of the United States. And right now, China is securing the territory that will help it secure its economic interests and and military interests while undermining the United States in the process.
And we have an article by our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury. It's called China is Steering the World Toward War. It really zooms in on the South China Sea dynamic there. So we'll be sure to include that in the show notes, and it gives it places it all in the context of Bible prophecy. Thanks very much for that, Anthony. U.S. President Donald Trump made some statements this week about the U.S. dollar, which sent the greenback into a dip. And this could have some implications for the dollar's status as the global reserve currency. For this, we'll go to Andrew.
Yeah, we talked quite a bit at the beginning part of this program about trade war and this new Mercosur trade bloc and prophecies in Deuteronomy about foreign economies besieging the U.S. And this other story is a less reported on story that's probably not going to have any profound implications in the next few weeks, at least, but definitely points to a bigger, longer-term trend that that proves and bolsters the things we were saying earlier. On Wednesday, President Trump tweeted that China and Europe playing big currency manipulation game and pumping money into their system in order to compete with U.S. We should match or continue being dummies who sit back and politely watch as other countries continue to play their games.
Wow, so he's actually threatening there to become a currency manipulator.
Right. He's definitely pointing out that China and Europe do use different techniques to devalue their own currencies.
Right.
So that other nations will buy their stuff because it's cheap. But he's like threatening in this tweet that, oh, America should do the same thing. That kind of fits in with his overall economic plan to make America an industrial base again. Generally, industry does or oftentimes benefits from a weaker currency because other nations want to buy your products. But there's a flip side to that, is that right now, really the only reason America can afford its massive astronomical $22 trillion debt is our interest rates are next to nothing because the dollar is the reserve currency. Everyone uses it in trade. Everyone buys it. It's in such high demand that we can send dollars to other nations and they don't have to pay hardly any interest on those dollars when we lend to other nations. Once you start getting in that currency manipulation game, might help American manufacturing a bit, maybe, but it definitely is going to weaken the dollar status. It's going to be less desired as a reserve currency. More and more nations will switch over to gold or euros or yuan, as they're already doing. Those interest rates go up, and I did an article we can put in the show notes earlier this year on when will the dollar collapse, that does some of the math showing that if interest rates double or triple, which is something that they were double or triple what they were now just 10 or 20 years ago, you get to a point where you're taking the majority of your tax income just to pay the interest on the debt, and you get in a death spiral where you just can't. You can't finance your economy anymore, which is something that goes right along with some of those curses that God said would come on a nation that does not submit to his laws listed in Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28. Those two chapters don't necessarily talk about interest rates specifically, but they do talk about economic blessings and debt you have economic blessings and low debt when you're blessed by God, economic curses and high debt when you're cursed by God. And right. So you can definitely, just looking at despite the uptick in the economy right now, looking at the long-term trends, you can definitely see it's a nation that's in the cursing portions of that chapter.
Please go to the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com to read Andrew's article about this that really places it all in the biblically prophetic context there. Thanks very much for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. The stories we're covering today are up on our website, thetrumpet.com, or they'll be there soon. if they're not there yet, along with some links to more in-depth literature that we've mentioned there. So please visit thetrumpet.com to get more information on these stories. Coming up, we'll talk about tensions between Iran and Britain, the EU's leaderlessness, a deeply significant G20 development that most of the media missed, and the purported obsolescence of aircraft carriers. We'll be back in a moment.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Hour. For our next story, we go back to the Middle East, where Iran is furious over a recent move by the British. To talk about this, we'll go again to Brent.
So we normally talk about sanctions that are placed on the Iranian regime, as we did in the first half, but many people forget that the Syrian regime, the nation of Syria, is under financial sanctions as well because of the Syrian civil war. And one of those sanctions is the transfer of oil products. They've basically been barred by the European Union themselves since 2011 from receiving oil. And yet, since 2011, they've received oil uninhibited, mostly by Iran, because Iran gives it to them for free and gives them IOUs for the future because Syria doesn't have any money. Well, this came to a standstill this week, at least with some of the oil, because there was a super tanker that sailed through Gibraltar, the Grace One, it's called. This is a vessel that has been known to be trying to skirt around U.S. sanctions on Iran by the Iranians. This time, though, it was taken and boarded by 30 British Marines that boarded the boat from fast boats and a helicopter after Gibraltar requested their assistance to basically take it and say, no, you can't sail through this territory. You are going to offload your cargo in Syria, and that is illegal under our EU regulations. And so they have taken the vessel. And this vessel is fully loaded, fully stocked. In fact, this is probably one of the reasons why it couldn't go through the Suez Canal from Iran, because it was so loaded. The Suez Canal can only take vessels that are submerged about 20 meters below the water level. And this one was so heavy, and they didn't want to offload some of the oil through pipelines across the Suez Canal. And so it had to go around all the way around the Cape of Good Hope there down by South Africa. And it was pinged by the British. This is a quote from Matthew Orisman. He looks into financial sanctions. He said this, quote, "This is the first time that the EU has done something so public and so aggressive." And then he says, "I imagine it was also coordinated in some manner with the US, given that NATO member forces have been involved."
So this is pretty exciting to see the British just, you know, showing some real backbone here. During the break, we talked about how the British have also recently sailed through the Strait of Taiwan there between China and Taiwan, just kind of following the U.S.'s lead to demonstrate to China that the international community, the U.K. and the U.S. don't believe that China owns that. The British have also shown some real spine, I think, in some statements they made about the Hong Kong situation to China. So it's exciting to see that happening with the British there. What do you think the Iranian leadership's view of Britain will be after this? What could we expect, any long-term change there?
Well, I guess the Iranian, the IRGC, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, have said that they're going to take out a British tanker in the Persian Gulf, and they will hold that until Britain gives up its tanker. We'll see if they actually do that or not. But here is what's interesting. I mean, imports of Syrian oil, it just happened to be an Iranian giving it, so it's, you kill two birds with one stone, basically. Bolton basically tweeted that he was very pleased that this happened, obviously. But the EU has been sanctioning Syrian oil and said, you're banned from importing oil for 8 years, and yet no one has done anything. And so the British have basically decided, we're going to enforce the actual European Union laws. We're finally going to stand up and actually do something that was in the books. Now, I think it is significant, the whole Iranian angle, that this oil was coming from Iran, but it's also very significant for Syria right now. over the past few months, they are in like a severe short, have a severe shortage of oil. A lot of the oil that Syria, that can be pumped out of Syria is in the east, and that's controlled by the Kurds right now. So the Syrian government doesn't have access to that. And so they've got to import 80% of their oil. And so the whole nation's on rations. 2 weeks ago, the main oil refinery on the coast of Syria blew up. For some reason, we don't know. They said it was foreign actors intervening. And so there is a really big push on Syrian oil right now. And this could really play into one of the Bible prophecies we're looking at regarding Syria, and that it is going to break off from Iran. Up to this point, Iran has had a green light to give oil to Syria. Nobody stopped them. And that was one of the main reasons that Syria, even though Iran came with a lot of negatives, it was the only way that it can maintain its oil, which I think it goes through about 1,000 barrels per day. But if Iranian oil is cut off from Syria, there's not too many things now in the plus column for perpetuating this relationship with the Iranian regime.
Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has written an article called How the Syrian Crisis Will End that really places these developments in the larger context and shows how it was specifically prophesied in Bible prophecies written thousands of years ago. So for any listeners who would like to understand that, please go to thetrumpet.com and we'll include a link to that article in our show notes. Thanks very much for that, Brent. Well, moving back to Europe now, where unlike Iran, there is no supreme leader, Ayatollah Khomeini, or any other supreme leader. Instead, in Europe, there's a crisis of leadership, and it was on full display this week. To tell us about this, we'll go back to Richard.
Yes, one of the big stories that's really dominated European news this week is the top leaders have spent this week kind of horse trading to figure out who's going to get the top European positions. We had those European elections a while ago. They still haven't figured out leadership. It's taken a long time after that, longer than normal, to get that sorted, and they finally kind of got their act together. But you see this really interesting trend where, on the one hand, the EU is dominated by Germany, and on the other hand, Germany is pretty weak and leaderless right now. So you get this situation where Europe is really turning to Germany, where you get a lot of people complaining about how many Germans are involved in Europe, where you had the top job going to a German, which caused a lot of people to a lot of complaints across the European Union. Then in some of these other kind of important directorships, one French journalist said that the Germans held 2/3 of the important director positions, 3/5 of the important head department positions. So you've got a lot of people complaining about that. But then at the same time, you've got Germany absolutely failing to provide any real leadership for Europe. So Europe can't really do anything without Germany. They can't do anything that Germany doesn't want. But then Germany is not making it clear right now what they do want. So what you saw over the last week or so is you saw Angela Merkel. She did put together a solution for Europe and a whole package of who all these different leaders were going to be. And it was shot down in flames. Politico wrote it was a humiliation the likes of which Angela Merkel has never experienced in her 13 and a half years as Chancellor of Germany. So big humiliation. She no longer has the political authority to push those kind of things through. So then people kind of got together. There was a lot of going back and forth. They came together with a new plan. The irony of the new plan is it put the German defense minister, Ursula von der Leyen, nominated her for the European Commission president, one of the 3 to 5 presidents of the European Union, depending on exactly how you count those presidencies. And so he put for her forward. Lots of people kind of felt like they needed to do Germany a favor, so they all nominated her. The only person that didn't vote for her was Germany. And in fact, the fact of her nomination is potentially going to cause the coalition in Germany to collapse. The Social Democrat, she's one of the most unpopular politicians in Germany, despite the fact that she's the only minister that's been at Angela Merkel's side throughout her whole chancellorship. And the Social Democratic Union, some in there are talking about pulling out of the coalition over this promotion for von der Leyen. So it's not a clear picture. It is a lot of chaos. It is a lot of uncertainty. But the fact that Europe just can't even get together and agree on a leader is really exposing this appetite or this need in Europe for strong leadership. I mean, anytime there is this jockeying for position on who's going to be one of Europe's 3, 4, or 5 presidents, does kind of bring up this whole mockery of having 3, 4, or 5 presidents. So now, well, it really puts the focus on Europe, the need for leadership, but then also specifically within Germany. The fact that there's a leadership vacuum within Germany and how that ends up paralyzing all of Europe.
So in the first half, you spoke about the Bible prophecies showing that the EU will soon be whittled down from 27 or 28 countries down to 10. How do you think this chaos and leaderlessness in the EU as a whole, but in Germany in particular, could contribute to that?
Yeah, it could be very closely involved. I'm not exactly sure on specifically how, but Mr. Flory did bring that up in that same article on the prospect of that Mercosur trade deal. That if we see Europe whittled down to 10 nations, that we'll probably see the strongman that the Bible talks about come into the fore as well. I mean, it may well be something like some nations are willing to submit to a strongman so that they can be leaner, so that they can make decisions, so that they can get things done. But then a whole lot of nations maybe aren't willing to submit to a strongman, and they'd say, well, no, it may be more efficient, but we value our freedom, we value our democracy, we're going to stick away from that. So that's just one scenario how you could see these two processes being very closely intertwined.
And where would you send listeners who would like to better understand that?
Well, Mr. Flory's booklet, A Strong German Leader Is Imminent, goes through those prophecies and explains why the Bible says you're going to see a strong leader in Europe, exactly what the Bible says about what's coming. So that really is the perfect place to get an understanding of this subject.
And we'll include a link to that in the show notes as well. Thanks very much for that, Richard. Well, the big G20 summit in Osaka, Japan has now come and gone. And there was one very significant meeting that the media seemed to have largely overlooked. But it highlights a deeply significant trend. To tell us about this, we'll go once again to Anthony.
Yeah, The Diplomat had an article this week that I thought did an exceptional job of really shaking people up and alerting them to some of the earth-shaking developments in Asia. The title of the article is Osaka G20, The Important Meeting Most Media Missed, and was written by a PhD candidate at the University of Tasmania. And like you brought up in the introduction, he said that not much of substance emerged from some of the meetings involving President Trump and some of America's allies. But he said that there were really two main big events that really emerged from this. And he talks first of all about a meeting that actually happened just prior to the summit, and it was actually an interview between Russian President Vladimir Putin and the Financial Times, where he underscored how essentially obsolete what the Western liberal order is. And then later you had other meetings that went on between India and China and Russia. And I'll just read what the writer says. He says, India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi has done what many thought he would not, extending a friendly hand to China at the most opportune time for the Chinese President Xi Jinping's Belt and Road Initiative and plans for transcontinental Eurasian integration. And these are topics that we talk about a lot, this Eurasian integration, and this was an important aspect of this G20 summit. And it talks about how China has been, or the United States has been, concerned about Russia's sale of missile defense systems to Turkey and India. And this all happened around the time of this summit, and these are two nations that were thought to be really pro-America, but now they are aligning more with Russia. The article continues, it also took place at a time when Putin and Xi have concluded their sixth meeting in just less than 2 months. They've discussed everything from Russia's integration into the Belt and Road Initiative to security in the Middle East, in Central Asia, de-dollarization of trade. It also says that the two leaders have also made it quite clear that they believe that the Western liberal order has failed to answer the most pressing questions of our time. Says that Russia and China are ready to take charge of the global responsibility. And it says that, however, unlike in the 1990s and in the early 2000s, this mutual agreement is rather rapidly growing in appeal among other actors. That is why you're seeing nations like India jumping on board as well. The article talks about Pakistan also jumping on board, and he references the Pakistan Prime Minister saying that, yeah, the geopolitical order is really shifting eastwards in a multipolar world, and Pakistan is ready to take advantage of this shift. So we're seeing really this these United Nations of Asia coming together, partly because of the decline in the Western world, and also because of the shared interest that these nations have. And this is something we've been talking about a lot here at The Trumpet, but now you're seeing a whole lot more people, other voices, making the same point and really trying to essentially wake people up to this concern.
Yeah, this week we also saw India say that it was going to continue to import Iranian oil. So another big sign there that they're, you know, very quickly, it shows that they're willing to sacrifice or potentially sacrifice their relationship with the United States and just move closer to Russia and China. It's a huge development. Could you place that in the context of Bible prophecy for us?
The Bible talks a lot about these Asian nations in Ezekiel, in Isaiah, and in Revelation. And specifically in Revelation, it talks about this. It calls them the kings of the East, and it talks about them amassing an army of 200 million men. And right now, we are seeing these nations coming together to really make that prophecy a whole lot more possible, a whole lot more feasible. And the partnerships that they are building right now, they are working their way toward the fulfillment of that prophecy. And we have a booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy, that goes through all the details and some of the developments we've been seeing over the past years, just reinforcing the veracity of those prophecies.
Thanks very much for that, Anthony. Well, in terms of aircraft carriers, the United States is head and shoulders above the rest of the world, but some experts are now saying that may not matter as much as America would like to think. To tell us about this, we'll go once again to Andrew.
Yeah, since World War II, if not well before, the United States has controlled the world's oceans, and the crown jewels of America's strategy for this, like you mentioned, are its aircraft carrier strike groups. It has 11 of them, extremely impressive, each one with 7,500 personnel, 70 planes, it varies, but like a dozen or so ships surrounding the main carrier, more military power than most nations. It was one of the just pillars of American military power that wasn't showcased at the military parade yesterday, seeing as that they're out at sea. But this is really kind of like built on America's power to control the world's oceans. But as you mentioned, there's a number of military analysts predicting a revolution in naval warfare science that could play well into some of the Bible prophecies. We've talked about this besiegement. We've talked quite a bit about this besiegement today, in that the aircraft carrier became like the strongest ship on the seas around World War II because of their range. Before that, the battleships, you have like these huge guns on a battleship that can shoot about 24 miles. But you've pretty much got to get within view of each other before you can shoot your opponent. An aircraft carrier can send a plane out 1,000 miles, maybe a little bit more.
Yeah.
And so you can fight whole battles without ships even seeing each other.
Wow.
But now with anti-ship ballistic missiles, some of the ones China's developing and that America has as well, have like a 2,000-mile range on it. So this retired Marine Corps general, he's mentioned in the article we can put on the show notes about how China could sink the U.S. Navy. He's talking about that with these 2,000-mile range. He's like, if you can mount these ballistic missiles on any old merchant ship, you can actually, if assuming the satellite technologies keeps pace with that technology, you can shoot at an aircraft carrier from 2,000 miles away, twice out its distance. And so he's recommending that, said in the future, we need to move away from these carrier strike group technology to a much larger fleet of cheaper ships, each equipped with a ballistic missile.
Because a merchant ship would cost, you know, a tiny, tiny fraction of what one of these aircraft carriers would cost. But yet, if they can accomplish the same thing, possibly even with a greater range, then that seems like a massive shift in just like the warfare expectations for how a conflict might play out.
Right, and a shift that could very well benefit Asian nations. Because right now, I mean, we have got, definitely America has the most technologically advanced Navy on Earth. But in terms of sheer number, you're looking at merchant ships. I mean, China has 3 times as many merchant vessels as the United States does. And if you start combining East Asian nations together, some of the kings of the East that are mentioned in some of the Bible prophecies, like Isaiah 23 and in the book of Revelation, you very quickly can add up like half the world's merchant ships. There's like 50,000 merchant ships that with the ability to cross oceans right now, and the East Asians own like 20,000 of those, so like 40%. And so just you have this massive fleet that can participate in this besiegement, this Deuteronomy 28 besiegement that we've been talking about throughout this program. And it really does get down to a crux that a lot of world leaders have forgotten today, is that it is God that gives victory in battle. I mean, you'll even see like the military parade they had yesterday, and it's kind of refreshing in a way to see the radical left's been so ashamed of America's military power and ungrateful for the blessings God has given it. So it is kind of refreshing in a way to see someone who appreciates the blessings God's given America, but that also comes with so many conservatives with the other side of the equation, is that you not only appreciate it, but you start taking credit for it.
Right.
And you don't, that gratitude doesn't come along with the repentance that would be needed for God to give victory in battle, where if there's these prophecies about a besiegement, it's very easy for God to direct world events in such a way as the next war is what with technologies that America's not good at, and those blessings are taken away.
What's the name of that article that you mentioned?
How China Could Sink the U.S. Navy.
Okay, we'll be sure to include a link to that. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Please visit us there to read more about the stories we're discussing today and to subscribe to our print edition and our news brief, which we send out most days of the week. Let us know what you think of the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel today, Andrew Miller, Anthony Chibadidwe, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks also to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. And we'll leave you today with the words of George Bernard Shaw. The single biggest problem in communication is the illusion that it has taken place. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.